Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
So not only are we, you know, we're going to name and shame, we're going to name and fame, but we're also going to create initiatives that might have a better chance of market-based solutions to the problems that, we have. And you know, that's, I suppose that's another way of, if I step back, it's another way of where I see Oxfam, which is Oxfam 70-odd years old. It's grown up in an era when the assumption was charities were responsible for doing good, corporates were responsible for making profit. And I think that assumption probably never held, but it certainly cannot hold in, years to come.
My guest today is Danny Sri Skandaraja, recently appointed Chief Executive of Oxfam Great Britain. Danny was Secretary General and Chief Executive of Civicus, a Johannesburg-based global alliance of civil society organizations. He was also the Director General of the Royal Commonwealth Society, where he was the first non-British and youngest person to head the 140-year-old organization. We're so grateful to have Danny here today as one of the original founding members of The Conduit. Danny, welcome.
Hello, Paul. It's good to be here.
So tell us about your earliest memories as a child in Sri Lanka.
My parents left me when I was about 14 months old because they were both going to pursue their postgraduate studies abroad and left me with my paternal grandparents on a little island off the coast of Sri Lanka. So, you know, Sri Lanka itself is an island, and on the north western coast are a spattering of tiny little islands, dry, fairly sort of semi-arid. And I grew up on one of those until I was six. And so my earliest memories are growing up in, a house with my grandparents who were looking after me. And, you know, it was, I suppose, for idyllic in many ways. I mean, small issues like we didn't have running water or electricity, but I knew no better. So my early memories are sunshine and sand and lots of animals and my grandparents.
Did something change?
Well, a couple of things changed, I think. One is that my parents finished their PhDs eventually and were ready to sort of reunite, I suppose. And I'd always been told that my real parents lived abroad, and I used to make up stories about them, about how I had many sisters because I'm the only child, and you know, had a sort of had an imaginary second life abroad with my where my parents were. But when they finished their PhDs, they although they had jobs in the Sri Lankan university system, they didn't want to come back. This is now the very early 1980s, before the onset of, civil war in earnest. But we'd already been affected by war. My uncle had been killed a few years before in a brutal attack, in a spout of intercommunal violence in the late 1970s. Their colleagues in the university said, "Don't come back if you're Sri Lankan Tamil and you're an aspiring professional. Don't come back." So my parents had to abort the plan of returning and being reunited in Sri Lanka, and so instead called me out. And they actually both had studied in Australia but couldn't settle in Australia at that time. There was still effectively the tail end of what's, what was called a White Australia policy. And so my dad ended up taking a job in Papua New Guinea, a random place he'd never been to and few people had ever heard of. But it was looking for junior academics and he needed a job. And so I met my parents when I was six and a half, and that was really the first time I met them properly, as we went to Papua New Guinea, where we lived for the next three odd years.
And how was Papua New Guinea different from your early days in Sri Lanka?
Well, obviously, I now had to deal with my parents, and which was a strange thing to, because I used to call my grandmother mother in Tamil, so I had a second mother now. So as a child, I suppose it was sort of, you know, it was like being adopted in some ways. Papua New Guinea was different because I had to learn English. I didn't speak a word of English when I came to PNG, and in fact, that's when I got the nickname Danny. My, you know, the teacher in my local school in, Papua New Guinea saw my full name, which is actually Dananjayan Sri Skandaraja. And she was Australian. She was rather intimidated by it. So she christened me Danny and Sri, which is what my sort of school textbook said for many years, hence. So it was a life of adjustment, adjusting to new parents, adjusting to new language. And really, a point in my life where, you know, I've never lived then in Sri Lanka since then for any real length of time. So for me, I suppose it was the departure from my old life to a new life.
And tell me about the stepping stones to a life in Australia.
So I suppose my dad finished his contract in Papua New Guinea. By then, the Australian immigration rules had loosened. But of course, by then, the war had really started in Sri Lanka and people were being killed and displaced and recruited into the armed rebel groups. So my parents applied for and got an economic migration a visa into Australia, and my dad and then my mum got teaching jobs at universities in Sydney. And so, yeah, we moved to Sydney.
So you then are catapulted into Oxford. You're the first Asian Australian to win the Rhodes Scholarship, and you choose to write your thesis on inequality and conflict in Sri Lanka, some version thereof.
Yeah. So I suppose that was my first opportunity really to reconnect with the story of why I ended up in random places like Papua New Guinea or Australia or Oxford. And so when I had the chance, first in an MPhil and then in a DPhil to, you choose any topic really within reason, I thought, well, let me try to understand why really I had been displaced, but why the society that I'd grown up in was so thoroughly affected by conflict. And so it was a time in the late 90s where there was a thesis, and you probably were familiar with it, where the conflict was caused by greed or grievance. So Paul Collier and amongst and other development economists were saying, well, actually, you could explain ethnic conflict around the world by the thesis of greed. So people were capturing resources, so rebellions would start because of an attempt to capture political economic resources. Whereas some of us, and I, including myself, thought, well, actually, grievance might still matter to explain why people go to war, why there's ethno-political conflict. So I looked at economic data primarily in Sri Lanka, but also in a bunch of other countries, to look at whether inequality really could explain, or partly explain, why there was intercommunal violence in a place like Sri Lanka.
And what's at stake in the debate between greed and grievance?
I think partly it's a classic left versus right type division in some ways. You know, you could, you know, it's simplistic, it's reductive, but in one sense the greed argument was people are inherently greedy and they will do whatever it takes. The grievance lobby, I suppose, would say, well, you know, unless you understand people's grievances and take care of those, you can't solve intercommunal violence. And so I think that was partly what's at stake. For me, though, there was something more. I mean, what was personally at stake was just to, I suppose I wanted to contribute to the understanding of what happened in Sri Lanka, the explanation, because to me it was too simplistic to say in Sri Lanka that it was a case of terrorism, or, you know, the Tamil Tigers, the LTT, was simply a terrorist group, because I had always suspected there was something behind that, and I wanted to cast a light on one aspect of that story, and hopefully contribute to the resolution or amelioration of some of the really traumatic impacts of conflict. I suppose it comes back to greed versus grievance, because the interventions that one's left with, if depending on which one of you choose, look very different. You know, if you think that this is motivation by greed, then it's about, you know, policing the capture of resources. If it's about grievance, then it's a political effort to address people's grievances. So and many more choices along the way.
So taking over at Civicus, and firstly tell us a little bit about what Civicus does.
So Civicus was created about 25 years ago as a global platform or an umbrella body for nonprofit civil society organizations, if you will. And the thinking at the time was just after the end of the Cold War, was that we needed a global body that would support and nurture this idea of an independent civil society, you know, non-profit organizations that would be the third sector, if you will, to fill the gaps where states and markets were failing. And it was started initially as an attempt to invest and strengthen civil society, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, but eventually became a global platform and probably the largest of its sort. So these days, Civicus has members in more than 180 countries. And in many of those countries, the most important members are the umbrella bodies at the national level. So in many countries, there are national associations of NGOs, just there might as there might be a chamber of commerce for business or a trade union body for trade unions. And Civicus, in some ways, is the sort of global umbrella of umbrellas representing the voice of citizens and civil society organizations at the world stage.
So your work on trying to understand the relationship between inequality and conflict in particular, and your sort of quest to re-understand or understand better the country of your birth, how did that affect what you did at Civicus? Did your research change what you did? Did it cause you to move the organization in a different direction?
Well, there's a missing step in that journey, or a misstep in that journey, one might argue, which is that, so I did my PhD, struggled. I in some ways, I shouldn't have done a PhD. And if anyone's listening who thinks that they want to do a PhD stands for pretty horrible death. It was a real struggle. My concentration span is at best a tough thing to handle, but trying to concentrate on doing a thesis was difficult. And I realized that I did eventually finish, but I realized in the process that actually I wasn't going to be an academic. And also because I thought achieving the sort of social change or the things that mattered to me were probably best done outside the academy rather than inside it. And the steps in between, I suppose, are that I then happened to end up in a think tank working as it happened on migration issues, but what that journey set me off was then 15 years now of working in different civil society organizations. And I think part of what happened was moving from the academy into a think tank, thinking I was going to do more research and more applied policy relevant research, ended up being in the management side of civil society organizations. And so the link to Civicus in some ways is there to strengthen and support, nurture civil society. And so having knocked about for 10 years in different civil society organizations, that was the link, if you will, on what took me to a sector body, a trade body, rather than a hands-on frontline NGO.
And so in some ways, you've come some ways full circle. You've been in an organization which has sought to strengthen the sector, support a sector. You're now in a hands-on managerial executive role in one of the most important civil society organizations in the world, in Oxfam. So let's talk about that a little bit. So what caused you to take the job, and what are you most excited about in your current role?
So for a while, I wasn't going to take the job, partly because I'd announced that I was leaving Civicus. It had been 6 wonderful years. We were living in Johannesburg for much of the time that I was at Civicus. We were going to come back to London because my wife works here in London, and I had lined up a year's paid fellowship at the LSE to work on economic inequality. So I was really excited, a year off from management headaches, and the idea of doing some more research and on inequality really excited me. And then this job came up at Oxfam. So as many people may have seen, the last year hasn't been a great one for Oxfam. And my predecessor announced his resignation about 6-8 months ago because he thought Oxfam needed a new leader to take it through its next phase. And so I saw the job and I was thinking twice. I thought, maybe I don't want this headache and be deep in a tough management job. But I had lunch with a friend who said, Danny, real leaders run into the fire, not away from it. And I suppose at its heart, it spoke to my ego. And I thought, okay, well, am I? Do I see myself really as a leader in civil society? Because if I do, the fire at Oxfam was a pretty big fire. And Oxfam's an organization I've long admired. One of my first fundraising activities in Australia was to do something called a Walk Against Want when I think I was 11, and I was raising money for what is now Oxfam Australia. So it's an organization I'd seen and admired from a distance, and I thought, okay, let me throw my hat in the ring. And I wrote in one sitting my application letter, and I wrote it from the heart, and I said to the chair and the board of Oxfam, you're a 70-odd-year-old organization, a national treasure, not just in Britain, but, in many parts of the world, one of the largest NGOs in the world. You've had a rough time. You've obviously had some shortcomings on safeguarding, but actually this is the platform, this is the burning platform that should drive more fundamental change, that in the rest of the 21st century, civil society is going to be really important, but the sort of big corporate branded NGO that's in the sort of aid business, transferring money from, or being the intermediary between passive donors and so-called beneficiaries, that doesn't work. We need NGOs to be much more creative, much more agile, much more disruptive. And if you want to reimagine what Oxfam could be in the coming decade, I'd love to help you. If you want to just increase market share in a tired-looking international development sector, I'm not your man. So I filed off the application letter thinking they'd never bite, and they bit. And so here I am.
So you're reimagining. So give us your to-do list in the act of reimagination. Where are you starting and where are you going?
So I started from the very, very beginning. One of the most exciting things in my few months so far was to go to the Oxford University archives, where Oxfam's archives are still kept. And I got to look at and touch, I wasn't allowed to touch it, but I did anyway, the original minute book when eight citizens in 1942 came together in the university church in Oxford University and wanted to do something about the fact that in Greece, which was now Nazi-occupied, there was a famine breaking out. And the Allies, including Britain, had refused to let food go through into Nazi-occupied Greece. And so these eight people said, we've got to do something about it. They formed what was then called the Oxford Famine Committee Relief, hence Oxfam, and said, what we want to do is raise money to provide actual food relief for those people in Greece, but we also want to challenge government policy, the Churchill government's policy of this blockade. And so part of reimagining for me in the Oxfam context is actually going back to the future, going back to those founding principles to say, we need organizations like Oxfam to both do things to alleviate poverty, to provide relief, to be there in humanitarian emergencies, but that's not sufficient. And instead, we need to also think about what are we doing to change policy, because the sort of band-aid relief, band-aid solutions aren't going to fix the structural drivers of poverty, injustice, and inequality. And so I think the exciting thing for me is that in all of these 76 years, in various guises, Oxfam has tried to do both. For me, the question for, say, the next decade is, what does that look like now? Especially when you think about the organizational form that sits behind that. You know, we're about 10,000 people who work across Oxfam. We're about €1 billion turnover confederation. There are many other different Oxfams registered in the world. In some ways, that's a huge asset. I mean, that is incredible in terms of the rest of civil society, which, you know, the average NGO is tiny and often doesn't even have any income. And so we are very much at the at one end of an outlier, if you will, on the civil society spectrum. The second bit of reimagining is big really beautiful for what we want to do? And if so, how? You know, perhaps it's when we're trying to provide humanitarian relief, we need to have scale because we don't know when the next disaster will be, and we want to create an organizational structure that can respond quickly and effectively to that. But on the other hand, if you're trying to do campaigning in the 21st century, the last thing I think we would want is a bunch of, you know, policy wonks or campaign wonks sitting in Oxford designing campaigns for people across the world. I mean, I think, you know, the cutting edge ways in which social change or social campaigning is being done is much more participatory, bottom-up. And you might argue that the NGO model of doing that is now looking a bit outdated. So reimagining in some ways is both about going back to those that purpose, being clear about the value add, and then trying to come up with an organizational form or forms that might best fit that function.
So let's start with the policy question. In what ways do you think the policy advocacy or the prescriptions that Oxfam should be articulating need to be different from how it's been for the prior 70 years?
So I think in some ways, particularly in a country like Britain, charities, all charities, but especially big charities like Oxfam, need to think about, you know, when and on what issues will we speak out? Because I fear that in countries like this, there's been a bifurcation, if you will, between many have argued that good charities, quote unquote, should stick to providing relief, doing good causes,
and that when charities speak out, that that's actually bad. And I think we need to make a choice about what are those issues that really matter to the causes we fight for. So if we want to end poverty, then we need to work out where are we prepared to lose friends, to speak out, to challenge power without being falling into self-censorship or being the so-called chilling effect that many people say has crept through British charities in particular. So I think that's one part. A second is this notion of you know, Oxfam now has a presence in 90 countries around the world. And if we want to build from below and beyond borders, which is what I think we should do, then when it comes to global campaigning, I think we need to come up with a better flow of how ideas are generated, how ideas are spread. And that needs to look different, because I think the sort of the last generation of global campaigning has tended to be led from the global north, has tended to be brand-led, has tended to focus on traditional nodes of power. It's been about coming up with something aimed at the G7 or the G20, and it's about increasing the level of aid to an issue. That feels tired to me. I think we can do better than that. And we need to do better than that because we also need to have truly global, truly inclusive campaigns that bring people from across the world together. So I think those are some elements that I think we need to be different. The bit that I'm excited about that I think is also undervalued in Oxfam is, you know, because we have this global presence and we have the scale, we're working at the front line on the issues that we care most about, delivering humanitarian relief or working to change gender norms, addressing sustainable agriculture issues. So I think we are better placed than most to develop advocacy positions based on that. So we have the expertise because we're day in, day out working on these issues. And most importantly, we're working with the people for whom this matters most. And so our job, I think, is to amplify, to facilitate those voices on those issues that matter and connect the local to the global.
So it's early days, and I suspect that your approach to this, as just articulated, is let the best ideas percolate from the people on the front lines and then distill those into the campaigns that you think are compelling and then go and win them. But do you have, based on your life experience and your track record, some sense of what some of those campaigns might be already? What are the sorts of things that Oxfam, with your leadership, might be championing, which are different and new and fresh than perhaps it's done in the past?
So I suppose one old, one new perhaps, and one old, and these are just sort of, this is intuition, I suppose. One old is very is around gender equality, gender justice. Oxfam proudly was at the vanguard of some of these issues. It had a gender and development unit in as early as 1985 to look at the gender aspects of development. And I think now is the time, particularly given the controversies of our failures around safeguarding last year, which, you know, went to the core of our belief that we were fighting for women's rights and gender justice, and yet we were allowing abuses of power to happen under our watch. And so I think, especially at a time of greater awareness of movements like Me Too, I hope Oxfam can once again be at the vanguard of championing women's rights. The other issue that intuitively I'm very attracted to is around this nexus between, you know, where does civil society stop and responsible business start? And for those of us at the bigger end of the NGO market, where we know Oxfam's got great relationships with progressive businesses like Marks and Spencer's, Unilever, Burberry, even on our secondhand fashion shop trade, and I think there's something interesting there to look in that space and see where can we add value. And it could be through partnerships with some of these big companies. It could be through better advisory to those companies that do want to transition into more responsible business models. It could be by setting up joint ventures or arm's length initiatives that test new ideas. And the beautiful thing about Oxfam is it's had this history. You know, it was one of the early investors in something called Cafe Direct, one of the early fair trade coffee companies. We used to co-own a clean energy company in the UK. We still own an ethical clothing company in Senegal. So I'd like us to play in that space more, to be pushing not just more responsible business, but to be pushing us into that
sort of fourth sector, as some people call it, the area of social innovation, social enterprise.
So let me ask you a sort of an age-old strategic question that leaders in the not-for-profit sector confront, particularly when it comes to business. When you talk about very big businesses with global scale and reach, they're not always perfect. And part of your role, presumably, in engaging with them is to move them to be better corporate citizens. And how do you judge the moment at which you decide to engage an imperfect corporate actor and thereby lend them your brand and the credibility that comes with it, versus a decision to stand outside and be the advocate and bop them on the head with all the piousness and ease with which that comes, but sometimes with none of the yields that engagement might otherwise provide?
So this is a very timely question, because I spent 2 hours with our private sector teams yesterday hearing about our work here. And this is you're right, it's an age-old challenge, and it's probably one that's not going to go away. So the Oxfam position, as told to me by colleagues, I find quite compelling, which is that given our scale, size, reputation, and potential to influence, we want to play across that spectrum. So Oxfam, you know, publishes things called Behind the Brands, a scorecard looking at the ethical behavior of brands. We've just launched something called Behind the Barcodes, which is looking at supermarkets and naming and shaming supermarkets that aren't serious about responsible supply chains. But at the other end of the spectrum, as I said, we've got partnerships that are very thick and developed with them. And that, as my colleague said to me yesterday, comes with all sorts of challenges, because we're trying to be insiders and outsiders at the same time. We've got the carrot and the stick. We've got the megaphone and the partnership. And that's difficult, but I would rather us be there with that spectrum of activities, again, because of our size. I mean, if we were a smaller NGO, perhaps I'd say we'd have to choose, and we'd got to be one or the other. But in our case, I think we can be at both, and it's both plus in some ways, because what I was trying to say earlier is that I think, you know, the bigger bits of civil society, the institutionalized bits of civil society, are, you know, also going to need to think about what are those initiatives that we can sponsor, inject, fund, invest in, that will create the sort of change that we want. So not only are we, you know, we're going to name and shame, we're going to name and fame, but we're also going to create initiatives that might have a better chance of market-based solutions to the problems that we have. And, you know, that's, I suppose that's another way if I step back, it's another way of where I see Oxfam, which is Oxfam 70-odd years old. It's grown up in an era when the assumption was charities were responsible for doing good, corporates were responsible for making profit. And I think that assumption probably never held, but it certainly cannot hold in years to come. And so therefore, as we see that sort of hybridization, an operative question for us is, where do we want to play on that, in that process? So it's sort of both and.
I want to ask some questions about your own leadership. You've taken over an organization at a time which is fair to say has had a challenge or a crisis. 70 years old, 10,000 people, $1 billion in turnover. This is not a small endeavor. It's probably in the kind of nautical lexicon a supertanker that you're trying to pivot. So how does a leader like yourself do that in a way that doesn't take you 5 years in a world in which we're running out of time to achieve the kind of change that you aspire to?
Wow, that's another timely question that's very much front of mind. Look, I've never worked in an organization this big or complex before. And so one thing that I'm busy trying to learn is, how do you even communicate or let, you know, your ideas or your messages in an organization this complex? In every other organization I've worked in, I've known everyone else who's worked there. I could walk over to them or pick up the phone and call them. So partly, I think it's learning in this sort of organization how to have conversations or communicate. Just, you know, if I think something, how do I get messages across? I think a key for our generation of leaders is also being clear about the need to walk the talk. You know, part of what I think I need to do is model the sorts of behaviors that the next generation of leadership, so I think in Oxfam language, what a feminist leadership would look like. So part of what I'm trying to do is being serious about walking the talk. You know, I've tried to be more transparent and open about what I'm doing. So we have an internal communications platform, Workplace, where I have my own channel, where I post regular updates, and also, more importantly, where people have a direct way of contacting me. So any of those 10,000 people can get in touch with me directly, instantly, privately, just if they want. It's a headache at times when the phone goes buzzing in the middle of the night because someone halfway around the world wants to let me know about something or complain about something. But then I'm publishing my own goals. So I've agreed with the chair of our board a set of targets and key performance indicators, and we'll be sharing that with everyone in the organization so that they can hold me to account. So I think there's part of it is about the habits of leaders and being clear about demonstrating those. And then the third element, which, again, I'm learning, is in a super tanker of this size, what is the best way to make change? And my intuition tells me it's probably about piloting, experimenting, innovating at the fringes, testing new ideas to say, you know, like, for example, you know, if we are to create a social enterprise, floating something that can be much more innovative and agile, and then learn using that to either drive change within the main system or to draw lessons, or perhaps where the joint venture, the spin-off ends up eating the parent. I think they're the sorts of models that we need to look at if we really are trying to reimagine and repurpose what the supertanker's for.
So during these conversations, we often ask leaders about moments of crisis or challenge or failure and what you've learned from that as a guide to others, because nobody's led a life where they haven't encountered any and all of those. And so it's always useful to hear your words about what you've done in response to those circumstances.
Yeah, there's no shortage of failures, and I think I've had the fortune or misfortune, I'm not quite sure, of working in some organisations that have had some trouble before I arrived, and I think the lesson I learned very quickly was that no matter how good you think your ideas are, if you don't bring people with you, you're doomed to fail. And I learned that very sharply in when I worked in the Commonwealth. For a while I was seconded into something called the Commonwealth Foundation, which is a small intergovernmental organization. We had 51 people on the board, many of them high commissioners representing countries. And the organization, in fact, that whole Commonwealth community of organizations needed some serious reform. And a bunch of us, including some of the high commissioners on the board, thought that, you know, we knew the way out. We had a very clever idea that looked beautiful on paper. But in an organization that complex with those, you know, that number of different interests at the table, we were doomed to fail, and we failed very dramatically because, you know, just a few votes. Institutional vandalism, as someone called it, and our project was scuppered. And I think I learned the hard way that, it, you know, doing that, the relationship building, the explaining, the listening, when it comes to driving through change is critical. And if you don't do it well enough, and even if you do, sometimes you're doomed to fail.
So people who are at an earlier stage in their career, if they're perhaps in their first job and they're either leading a life of purpose or increasingly wanting to build a life where they look back with their last breath and say, I've left the world a better, more inclusive, gentler, more just place. Given that you've led that kind of life and have much more to contribute in the years ahead, what do you think, what advice would you give to a younger person who's trying to build a career and a life commitment in this sector? What should they be doing to prepare themselves?
So perhaps counterintuitively, I think my advice wouldn't be don't just limit yourself to the sector. I've argued elsewhere that perhaps we're at the beginning of the end of the charity sector as we know it. For all those reasons I've just talked about, that, you know, actual social change is likely to happen in more hybrid or market-based solutions or interventions. And we, you know, in some ways we might be at peak charity. There's something like 7% of the British workforce works in a registered charity of one form. If I were to put money on it, I would say that number is going to fall in years to come because of the sorts of financial flows, the shape of the sector. And so I think we should be sector agnostic when it comes to purpose, because the world I want to see is a world in which everyone, no matter where they are in society, should be inspired by purpose and should be held to account for a broader set of impacts and values. And so I think the I suppose one bit of advice is to sort of think through where and how do you want to make that change, that positive impact. For me, it's been a relatively straightforward, you know, if not accidental, but it's at some points accidental, but it's a fairly straightforward journey because I've only pretty much worked in civil society, in nonprofits. But I think, I hope that many more people who might be deep inside a mean bank exploiting, you know, making huge amounts of profit, who can still, though, make huge amounts of change. And I don't think we in the third sector have a monopoly on purpose, and nor should we.
Many times when it is called to act, it's in a context of either conflict or inequality or the consequences of climate increasingly just directly affecting the lives of ordinary people. And there are ways in which you can view the future and through a very dark lens and be very pessimistic and frightened. And I think no reasonable person should not think in a very sanguine way about the future. On the other hand, we have to get up every day and lead our lives. And so leave us with a cause for optimism. What would you tell your children or your son about what there is to be optimistic about and what it takes to bring that vision of optimism into reality?
So I'm convinced that this is the century of the citizen, because for most of human history, we've been subjects. We were ruled over by monarchs or chiefs or some hierarchical power structure. For the last couple of hundred years, give or take, with the advent of democracy and capitalism, we've effectively, I think, become consumers, and in many cases, deeply unhappy consumers who are breaking the planet. And I think there's only one direction of travel, which is the century of the citizen, where we become much more active, engaged citizens, where we connect with each other and co-create our futures in much more interesting and meaningful ways. And my reading of where we are in world history at the moment is that we're seeing very clearly where markets and states and political institutions have failed us. So we've got, you know, falling levels of trust, the planet is burning, political institutions don't seem fit for purpose, they're based on some, you know, notion of a sort of Victorian notion of democratic participation. And what we need to move to are institutions that put participation at their heart. We need to, we need a participation revolution where, whether it's in business or market solutions, whether it's in political institutions, we need to have much more meaningful participation, everyday democracy, liquid democracy, as people call it. And I think why I love being in this sector at this moment is because I think civil society organizations, especially the better resourced ones like Oxfam, hold a key, not the only key, but a key to unlocking that century, that sort of emancipatory potential. And it goes to the heart of the Oxfam challenge, which is, can we reimagine an Oxfam that itself is far more participatory, that doesn't have, you know, is not based on a passive notion of charity, but a much more active sense of mutuality, so that we don't see ourselves as sort of black box intermediary taking money from donors and giving it to beneficiaries, but connecting both in more meaningful ways, building from below and beyond borders, as I said. And I think that's the challenge. And I'm optimistic that there can only be one direction of travel, because you can't put the participation genie back in the bottle. We can't go back to an era of opaque, closed institutions. But the growing pains are difficult, because that's why we have the politics we have at the moment, why we have the markets or the corporate institutions we have. But the responsibility for all of us, regardless of where we find ourselves in society, what sector, quote unquote, we work in, have a responsibility, I think, to reimagine what that century of the citizen should look like.
Thank you so much for your words of inspiration. A liquid democracy. I think I'll drink to that. We hope to see so much more of you in the years to come. And good luck with your new role.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of inspiring change makers.